Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the recent UK visa restrictions on some African countries. I'm joined by two special guests, Dr. Lucy Hoville and Mr. Raymond Asfor. Dr. Hoville is a published global expert on asylum and displacement within the broader context of migration. With over 25 years of experience working abroad with a different range of governments, non-governmental organizations, and donor. Ulisi currently works with, is a partner at Expectation State, but she also works as a civilian expert for the UK's government office for conflict stabilization and mediation, and also a UN expert for rapid response, among many other roles. And Raymond is the CEO and co-managing partner at Expectation State, a global development consultancy, and also he's got a vast experience working with and alongside a wide range of donors, including the UK's Foreign Commonwealth Development Office, USAID, EU, United Nations, and a host of other organizations. Guys, it's a pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to a wonderful conversation.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. So let's start off. So we've seen in recent times the new Labour Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, who herself is... I think a child of an immigrant, express that, has the Labour has announced a plan to halt a visa for citizens of Angola, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Namibia for refusal of these countries to accept failed asylum seekers or deportees. So let's start off. Why these three countries?
Wow, that's a really good question. I'm not actually sure why those particular three countries, except I think one of the problems here is that the returns agreements that have been set up aren't really functioning very well. So I imagine that's largely what sits behind that. But I think to a certain extent, it has to be understood as really as kind of scapegoating, if you like, for broader failures in the asylum system more generally. So I think a lot of the detail is almost less relevant than the broader approach that sits behind it.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Raymond, do you want to add to that?
No, I think that Lucy's covered
that. Okay, brilliant. So we've seen, let's stay in the UK for a while. So we've seen from the last government, Rishi Sunak, maybe from Boris Johnson, then to Rishi Sunak, they had the agreement with Rwanda. And then we've seen Labour as well. You think Labour will be different, but migration seems to be a sticking point. It seems to be one where both parties use. So is there a genuine concern about migration? Is this just politics? Raymond, do you want to
Yeah, sure. No, I don't think it's just politics. There's a genuine concern about migration. Recent YouGov polls have migration actually as the number one issue of concern across the UK population. So that's beyond the health service, that's beyond the economy. It tends to kind of fight with economy, if you like, for number one issue of concern. So I think in this instance, the fact that it is such a live topic at the political level is a reflection of it being a significant concern across the population. Now, the degree to which that concern is properly understood, is properly being diagnosed and is being talked about through the lens of facts rather than rhetoric, I think is another question. But for me, it definitely is reflective of its importance in the kind of psyche, if you like, of the UK population. And that's not just, as we've said, based on, you know, numbers of people coming and going. It's based on really an uptick, although that has massively changed in the last sort of 7-8 years. It's really an uptick in just this hyper focus that we've seen within the media, but also then reflecting now in very significant, which means that every party, you know, sees it as an issue that they have to grapple with and be very vocal about.
Listen, let me Raymond mentioned something that is quite succinct about where we look about optics of this issue, how we separate reality from fact. So there's you mentioned, Raymond talked about the economy, but then again, we've seen something that looks like a paradox. Whilst we're talking about all of that, the UK, on the other hand, have also had agreements with several countries to bring more workers in there, whether it be in the care or whether it be in the teaching, whether it be in the head, so to where they have where they don't have enough workers. So how do you resolve this paradox?
Yeah, I think this is the problem, is that it feels like the debate, as Raymond said, isn't so much based around sort of facts, but really around a lot of the myths that lie around it. And I think part of this is this assumption, and I guess maybe it's conflating a couple of things here, that the broader discussion on immigration has become very conflated with the very specific conversation around asylum. And they are two quite distinctive but really connected issues. And I think the problem with the latest policies to come out of the Labour government is that it kind of penalises asylum seekers for some of the broader problems around immigration, if you like, if they are problems. And I think that what you've pinpointed is the fact that, yeah, we want and we need people to be working in the country. And yet at the same time, somehow that's been conflated by people arriving on small boats who are looking for asylum. And they are two slightly different issues. And I think it's helpful to keep them slightly apart.
Brilliant. Rebel, let me come to you. Let's look at the legality, or I don't know if we'll talk about legality or the morality of the whole situation. Then look at the UN stance or the international stance on asylum seekers. And how Luis has rightly mentioned how all of these are conflated. Even we can't distinguish between legal migrants or illegal migrants. And you mentioned the boats. Some migrants also come through legal means. Maybe they overstay. Can you just differentiate all of these different dynamics of migration or asylum? Just unpack it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Lucy will be much better placed to unpack the kind of particular definitions and where they sit legally. But I think the key thing to unpack first and foremost is exactly that point Lucy mentioned. The vast majority of individuals that migrate to the UK do so within a policy framework that is approved by government. So they come to work under visa rules which are approved by government. They come to study and pay a huge amount into the UK university sector, which is obviously a critical sector for the economy. So this idea that migration is out of control is really, I think, a narrative which is very, very unhelpful. You know, has the government in the UK got control of small boats crossings? No. Does the UK and government overall have control of migration as an issue? Largely, yes, I think. You know, when you look at the fact that we're talking about less than 5% of individuals arriving to the UK are coming here through illegal means, 95% of people coming to the UK are coming here through a policy framework that's been created or tacitly approved or regulated, if you like, by the UK government. So it's a really difficult and emotive issue for a lot of people. But I think to use that saying of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, it's really unhelpful to conflate this issue of asylum seekers with migration and the role it has in the economy more broadly. And because it's unhelpful, not just because it's a really crass and frankly rough-handed way of doing it, but also it's not helpful because migration and labour flows are a critical part of an economy and a critical part of the British economy. But Lucy, I don't know if you want to, you know, talk a little bit about the different aspects of terminology and legality around the use of certain terms.
Go for it. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think people who are fleeing in search of asylum are they're asylum seekers. Once they get that asylum status, they become known as refugees. And they are a very particular, if you like, subsection of people who are moving around the world. And they're people who are recognised under really strong and robust international legislation. The 1951 Refugee Convention is very clear in its definition of who a refugee is. And I think that understanding that these are people who haven't chosen to live in a conflict zone and have to leave their homes is really critical. They are people in need of international protection. And so someone who is fleeing, for instance, conflict right now in Sudan and maybe fleeing to Egypt, they're no more Egypt's responsibility than they are, say, the responsibility of the United Kingdom or the US or any other country in the world that signed up to this international protection, if you like, that a lot of countries have signed up to. So I think it's just really helpful to understand. And of course, not everyone coming over, for instance, on the small boats is an asylum seeker or will get refugee status. We know that, but a lot of them are because they haven't found another route to find that kind of that source of protection.
You mentioned people fleeing conflict zones, and I've written quite a bit on this topic as well. And one of the things that I found out in the research is like I think Raymond mentioned 5% of people that actually contract legal means. There seems to be a migration myth, looking at the numbers, where the outflow of people from Africa to, like, the migration of those fleeing is within neighboring. You mentioned from Sudan to Egypt. It's roughly more than 80% is within Africa. And not much is coming to outside of Africa. So why do we focus so much on this outflow without looking at these numbers? What's the actual number? Why do we focus so much on the small percentage and not on the bigger picture, the bigger percentage that is within Africa itself?
Yeah, I think so much of the conversation around this issue is it's very kind of one-dimensional, and it's very much we take it from in a very, if you like, without putting it in its broader context. So as soon as you disassociate the reason that people are moving from that movement itself, then the whole discussion becomes very skewed. And what that means, obviously, in Europe is that it focuses on the small boats arrivals and people arriving irregularly rather than on that broader context of forced migration in which people have moved. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, we know that the vast majority of movement within Africa is rural to urban migration. That is by far the largest amount of movement that's taking place. Then there is next to that is some cross-border movement. And yeah, from Sudan at the moment, there has been quite a lot of cross-border movement because of the conflict there. And the numbers are really stark in neighbouring countries. And it's an incredibly small percentage of that overall number of people. Even if you just look at those who are fleeing asylum fleeing in search of asylum at the moment, the number of those who are coming to Europe is incredibly small. And so I think that it's this need all the time to keep that in perspective. So I think the statistics are that by the middle of, say, 2024, there were about 37.9 million refugees and 8 million asylum seekers worldwide. That number has actually gone up since then. And of those, about 71% were hosted in low and middle income countries. And the vast majority were hosted in neighboring countries. So we are talking about Uganda, Kenya, Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, really as some of the key countries. That same year, to put it in perspective, 62,000 approximately people were granted refugee status or other protection following an asylum application in the UK. So the numbers are really, really small, relatively speaking. And I think we lose perspective so quickly on this. As you say, it's the visibility of the small boats or of people coming irregularly that kind of skews the whole discussion.
Raymond, I see you've worked with a range of different development agency, America, and all of these. Let's focus on East Africa. Lucy mentioned East Africa, Uganda, Kenya. I know that there's a lot of internet displaced people in this place. But I want to focus on DRC, one of the countries that were restricted. And we see DRC has kind of like become a poster child for the kind of conflict that we're talking about, or become a site where you see not just internet issues. So I want to look at it from the development that maybe your organization do. Look at how you have it's become a battleground for the Chinese, American, who are all battling for the minerals in there. And also we throw in the region, I want to throw in Rwanda in the mix as well, and what's currently going on in the mix. So I'm just pointing out the irony of how the conflicts, even in Sudan, we could talk about Sudan as well. I look at how external countries are also supporting and prolonging those conflicts. So how do we deal with those irony when we want to talk about stopping the boat, for instance, or dealing with migration without talking about the source? We're talking about these other factors that make this kind of illegal migration or forced migration happen in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're kind of absolutely right in diagnosing is that what we're talking about is a systemic issue, which isn't just related to one particular aspect of this, which is the percentage of people kind of traveling by boat to go to a country in Europe or elsewhere, but actually a much more systemic problem around instability causing displacement in the first place, climate increasingly becoming a factor of displacement, and what we do about that. Obviously, what we've seen in the last probably 5 to 6 years, I think it's fair to say, but certainly accelerated in 2025, was a massive drop-off in countries across Europe and North America. In the first instance, taking a step back from what they used to class as their international obligations around the international aid system and contributing money either bilaterally, so the likes of the US government through USAID or FCDO in the UK, or multilaterally through UN institutions or other multilateral institutions towards addressing the root causes of displacement, and whether that's conflict, climate related or otherwise. So it's not just the case of, well, do you know what, we're focusing on boats. We've also begun to step back as organizations as countries across Europe and North America from what we used to consider our obligations as countries to address issues of poverty, but also instability across the world. So that's definitely a void we're seeing. In terms of what that looks like from a regional perspective, yes, there's unfortunately going to be and will continue to be conflict and instability across various parts of the world. We've seen, and Lucy's been talking about clearly, the really terrible conflict in Sudan. And I was in Cairo about 2 weeks ago working with a number of stakeholders around Sudanese refugees as well as Syrian refugees in Cairo, and how they do or don't integrate into the greater Cairo local economy. The economic aspect of a lot of this is really worth looking at. We often look at the movement of refugees through the kind of coping lens of how do I get safety for myself and my family, and that's absolutely number one priority. But life very quickly turns towards survival. How do I get money in the longer term? You know, what work can I do? What's my livelihood going to be? And so on and so forth. And for me, this is something which is worth focusing on a little bit, and we can get into it if you'd like, which is around the economic prospects. In a lot of the countries we're talking about, it's around the anticipation of people growing up and getting a job, which everybody wants to do, but the reality that the number of jobs available in the job market and the labor market does not keep pace, has not kept pace with demographic growth. Mm-hmm. And I see that as something which, frankly, the international community is struggling to call out and diagnose. There's still a lot of talk about, you know, if we can increase GDP growth by 0.5%, you know, 1%, we're going to create X numbers of jobs. We still have huge swathes of unemployed individuals who, to my mind, we take a short-term policy outlook and say, hey, we'll increase jobs. That hasn't happened over the last 30 years. I'm not sure why we think it'll happen over the last next five years to any significant level or any transformative level. And I think that's also an issue we need to look at within this broader system that we're diagnosing.
Yeah, Rama, let me stay with you for a minute, because you did mention something that aligns with the kind of work that I'm doing at the moment, looking at the prospect of liberal democracy, especially in Africa, and how whether liberal democracy is compatible or looking at its capitalist roots, which you've rightly mentioned, looking at how it creates this kind of global inequality and all of that. But we're currently seeing in Africa now, we're seeing some kind of, if you like, political consciousness among these. Africa has the youngest demographic of youth. So you're seeing this political consciousness, this revolt, if you want to call it, across, if you saw in Kenya, Madagascar, and all of these places. How do you think that this system you're talking about, on one hand, we're seeing global multilateralism retreating, and we see protection in America, we see Donald Trump, you know, the kind of like protectionist, America first kind of. But on the other hand as well, we're also seeing that we're kind of like interconnected, that we can separate these issues. So how do Africa balances all of these tensions? What are these tensions indicating or pointing to that we're seeing currently seeing in Africa? And then again, seeing also that the military is kind of hijacking some of these people's revolt. So does the future look bleak, or does it look like it's something that's going to lead to a change in a way?
Yeah, big question around the future there. I think the first thing it's worth taking into account, particularly where we're looking at political systems, we're often looking at national political systems. And I think it's helpful to look at that at a kind of national level, country by country level, if you like. So clearly, you know, two countries are the same, and it's very important to diagnose the both the political structures, but the power structures in the company accordingly. Does the future look bleak? I think it depends. I think often we see policy stances which don't go quickly enough. And there's a lot of, frankly, government bureaucracy that we see that slows things down. The need really, in my mind, is to conduct a fairly radical amount of deregulation around entrepreneurship and allowing individuals to take a little bit of control of their own economic future. A lot of the time we think of, you know, economic dependency in countries we work in through the lens of, okay, somebody might think they can get a good public sector job, great, but the public sector wage bill isn't really a healthy thing to increase too much in a country. Or they think they'll join, you know, a large corporate or a large organization, also good, but that's, you know, always in danger of being offshored or taken to another country, another jurisdiction. And for us, the ability to become an entrepreneur, take destiny into your own hands, and begin to start a small business where you're employing 2-3 other people. You know, these sorts of organizations make up 85-90% of most economies. That's the thing I think we want to be able to harness and see how we can unlock where we can micro enterprises and entrepreneurs. And sadly, a lot of the time it's quite difficult. It's much easier to start these sorts of initiatives in the informal economy, so below the radar of government, than it is to formalize it, because, you know, it takes a lot of time to put a company together. You need capital that's hard to get. Then the tax man starts looking at you, not through the lens of you avoiding tax, but just through, you know, pestering you or making life difficult. So I think for me, unleashing entrepreneurship is a large part of this, because it's not just around income, it's around hope. For me, when I think of unemployment, to my mind, pragmatically, there will always be unemployed people. The issue is, how do we decouple a lack of employment from a lack of fulfillment in life? Because I think that's often what causes problems systemically. And this is the thing we're not talking about. So I was interviewing somebody quite recently who was telling me they work for the Job Creation Commission in Ethiopia. Ethiopia needs to create 10,000 jobs per day, 3.5 million jobs a year. Where's that coming from? And is that, should the plan be that we should make the planning assumption that those jobs will be created? Or should the planning assumption be that we should still accept that there will be large swathes of unemployed across, you know, a lot of the countries we're talking about? I think it's the latter. And I think we should be planning from a policy perspective as to how we deal with that through the lens of a healthy society and healthy individuals who can still get a degree of fulfillment, given economic prospects aren't going to change overnight and may in some cases get worse.
Lucy, let me follow up on what Raymond was saying. And I can relate that to when I was doing research more than 10 years ago. I think it was around that time that the United Kingdom had the conflict and stabilization kind of like fund that looks to, which the whole idea was to deal with conflict at the source, conflict that's going to prevent how it's going to affect the United Kingdom. So at the time, there was a shift in the policy, in the United Kingdom policy, where they kind of integrated defense, development, and all that kind of into one single policy. So in Nigeria, the part of Nigeria where I work, the Niger Delta area, where they had the oil militants at one point. So they started using what they call a market strategy, where from what Raymond was saying, they go to like people like maybe women that have been affected in this conflict that are like farmers or fishers, and then they give a, I don't know if it was a loan or some kind of like grants to start. So when you look at that, what Raymond is saying and that approach, I don't know, I think you've worked with the conflict and stabilization department in the UK. Do you think that strategy is still working? Are they still deploying that? Is that, how do we see that in the last 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, Raymond, it would give you a better answer on the sort of technicalities of that. But what I can say that I've seen, certainly from the point of view of people actually getting a bit fed up and taking the incredible risk of getting on a boat. I mean, West Africa is an interesting example at the moment. Recently, there's been a significant increase in people taking the incredibly dangerous route from normally Senegal to the Canary Islands. It takes about 7, 8, 9, even 10 days in a wooden boat. Right. And the death rate could be anything as high as 25%. And it's really, really bad. Now, quite a lot of the people who are taking that route are from places like Mali, where they're fleeing conflict, or Mauritania, where they're fleeing slavery and other human rights abuses. But some of the people, and I interview quite a number of people who in the Canary Islands a few weeks ago who had recently arrived. And it was really interesting because for a lot of people, it was this thing of, I mean, one young man said, my family have been fishing for generations, but now we have trawlers who've taken all the fish and there are no fish left to be had. And for me, that's kind of like a basic level of, we've had all these clever ideas of handing people grants and giving people bits of money here and there, but actually the structural factors that drive people's lack of ability to get a job haven't been addressed. So it comes all the time back to these sort of systemic issues that we just don't really grapple with. So yeah, as much as the different components of the international community, whatever that is, have handed out piecemeal bits of money here and there in communities, sometimes to women, sometimes to this profile group. It's just been, I mean, you know, we know this so well, it's just sticking plasters on a situation. We need to get to some of those systemic injustices that lie behind it, or nothing really changes. That fisher is still going to go out and find that there are no fish left to get, and therefore they're going to look for alternative means. And we know that, I mean, young people all over the world like to go off looking for jobs. That there's nothing strange about young people wanting to move, and so that's precisely what they're doing. It's just that they're having to pay an incredibly high price in order to do it.
Raymond, let me ask you, if we, because you mentioned earlier about the shift from multilateralism and how organizations like the US are withdrawing from sponsoring, you know, USAID and all of this stuff. But a lot of us people have also seen that as something that could spur African, it's some kind of independence you know, in Africa. And Lucy, you mentioned dealing with systemic issues. One of my criticism of let's say Western liberal intervention in places is like there's this focus on stabilization. Whereas maybe in the 90s or so, you could see where they want to deal with political solutions. But right now, it's just about stabilization. Whereas stabilization is rather not the outcome, but just, you know, we need to deal with how it affects in the immediate sense of things. But again, we can also remove the fact of agency of the host countries, or the countries in Africa, and how that could also disincentivize them from dealing with the systemic issue. So do you think, Raymond, this is some sort of, it could also be some blessing in disguise? Can African leaders have to step up to the plate following, you know, their citizens putting more demand? Can it make them to pull more demand on the leaders to do what they need to do?
Yeah, I think you put your finger on a really important word here, which is agency. It's something we think a lot about in our company Expectation State, where we look to be what we tend to term majority world-led country, where we're only basing ourselves in the countries in which we work and making our team up for individuals who live and are from those communities. And the agency aspect of international development, to use the term as a sector more broadly, has really, we think, been lost or drowned out over the last 20 years or so. I don't think it's for me to say whether it's a blessing in disguise, but I definitely think it's an opportunity. And we're seeing those discussions, if you like, happening in some of the countries in which we work in governments and also outside of government, of saying, you know what, because I think the US's retreat, if you like, from its own self-imposed international obligations around spending money through USAID, it was so stark and so quick that it wasn't a gradual decline. It was a, this is shut, this is closed. And I think, frankly, a lot of governments have just seen a partner that's just became incredibly unpredictable and just vanished overnight. And so in a way, I do think there was a groundswell of opinion of saying, actually, this is maybe an opportunity for us to reorientate parts of our economy or parts of our budget systems or parts of our planning frameworks to be less dependent on aid. Now, the reason I don't want to be blasé about that is because the money matters to people, getting money to people who are, let's call it, the bottom of the pyramid or whatever term you want to use from an economic perspective. It is a matter of life and death for some people, so we can't be flippant about it. For me, the really unfortunate thing, it was the lack of nuance over the last 5 or 6 years, and I think that began certainly in the UK when there were discussions of getting rid of the Department for International Development, of a delineation between what was humanitarian aid and what was development aid. So in other words, aid which directly goes to save lives of individuals, let's say that's related to food or clean water or vaccinations, versus aid which is given to be in a slightly more complex way to address a slightly more complex system. So strengthening of civil society, you know, building up transparency of accountability, strengthening governance systems. And I think we just talked about aid. Let's just cut aid. Actually, I think cutting aid from a development perspective seems to me to be an issue of national interest and political persuasion. So in other words, you can have a difference of opinion on it. I actually think cutting aid from a humanitarian perspective, arguably, some might say, is slightly more of a moral issue, but that's for individuals to decide. I think the key thing that has become really obvious in the last 10 years is we cannot pretend that we can strip national interest out of this issue. These things are being looked at through the lens of national interest. And I think that was probably always the case, but never advertised. And I think it's become really clearly advertised in the last 5 or 6 years that, hey, this isn't good for us, so we're just stopping spending our money in this way. And I don't think that's healthy.
I like that you use that word. So one of the conclusions that I've just done in one of my recent article that is coming out is like there's no intervention that is altruistic. There's always a strategic interest behind all of that. And I think in the last whatever years, you say, Western intervention, and one of the reasons why it's taking a slack in Africa is there's not that transparency to say this is what we're doing. And then there's now competition with Russia, with China, and these people are not mincing words about what they want. So it seems now we see a lot of transactional with Donald Trump, this kind of transactional relationship. So listen, I wanted to ask you, Raymond, we did talk about agency, but let's talk about leverage. So amongst all of this multiplayer competition in Africa, and the way it's having to, you know, compete with China, not just the super, also middle powers, Turkey, and all of these places, what leverage does Africa have? Does Africa have some leverage to establish its own interests or to achieve its own interests?
Yeah, and I mean, this comes to the fore very clearly around discussions around displacement and migration, I think. And just to say that it has been very transactional, to use that word before I get onto the leverage. But I think what's really interesting is, for instance, Uganda in the last few days has announced that it won't give refugee status to Eritreans, Somalis and Ethiopians because those countries, it no longer classifies them as being in a situation of conflict and therefore they don't merit refugee status. And I think what's interesting here is that this is not a discussion about whether they're still conflict areas or anything else. This is the Ugandan government saying, you have asked us to host 2 million refugees for decades. You promised us assistance to do that, and you haven't even funded half of the budget that we need. And then add into that the fact that for decades now, the international actors have been telling us to put refugees in camps because you can count them more easily, you can assist them more easily. It just makes everything from a humanitarian perspective more straightforward. Yeah. But people in camps are extremely vulnerable when aid is withdrawn because basically we've created this kind of semi-permanent crisis. So that is one example. This is the Ugandan government saying, we are so fed up with all these broken promises and you've told us to keep people. So that comes on to leverage, which is, and this isn't really leverage, and I think it's a horrible, horrible idea, but somewhere sitting in the background of all of this is the extent to which vulnerable populations become a point of almost negotiation. So to a certain extent, you could say that a lot of international aid has been used as a tool to contain people and to stop them moving. And I think that the West, or maybe minority North-based governments, whatever we want to call them, have tried to have this hegemony on movement and to control it. So, I mean, we know that movement was, during colonialism, we know which direction the movement was going, and no one was given a choice as to whether boats arrived on the shores of West Africa from Europe. And now we're trying to control what is happening, if you like, in reverse. And so I think from a leverage point of view, it does become really, really complicated because it is, as soon as you start thinking of it in those sort of transactional terms that actually involve people's lives, it's really, really frightening. I mean, yes, and sure, coming to some of the rest of your question, there are other players entering the arena or who've been there all along and are coming to the fore. But I think the gloves are really off now in terms of, as we say, that sort of pretense that somehow these structures were being done for the greater good, and a sort of philanthropic angle to it, if you like, has definitely, that kind of myth has definitely been slightly blown out of the water. That's not to say that there isn't some extraordinary philanthropy going on, but the extent to which that's coming through the sort of government type money, has really shifted, as Raymond said.
Raymond, I was going to ask a question before. How does the UK's position or its recent, what I would say, bold talk about migration, how does it mirror Trump's kind of migration? So is it a copycat? Does it mirror Trump's approach, or should it look at it in its own right?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it back actually to domestic UK, because Lucy and I have been working on these issues for very many years internationally. And, how do we help organizations become more effective, diagnose the problem more, more accurately, look at bringing more research to bear on what they do. And we'll continue to do that. But ultimately, those policies overseas are also being informed by domestic sentiment. And I think for me, it's less of a comparison with, you know, what's happening in the US and much more the domestic sentiment, which, as we talked about at the beginning, is real. There's an issue in terms of people's different opinions on the role migration should play in the UK. And I think what I would do is give the analogy that we all often find very helpful of, if you imagine this is a spectrum. On the one end of the spectrum, we have borders completely open. Everybody can come and go as they please. And on the other end of the spectrum, we have borders completely closed. Nobody can ever enter the country. There are very few people who sit here. It's a spectrum. We all exist in different parts of the spectrum. Mm. Some people, you know, absolutely in support of economic migration, don't like asylum seekers. Others feel like we have a huge moral obligation to take asylum seekers. But we're on this spectrum. And the thing which I find really discouraging, frankly, about discourse in the UK is, particularly at the political level, when you look at, you know, the recent debate on Question Time on migration, I think it was just last week, we have five or six individuals arguing for distinct positions, and they're trying to garner support for their position, whether that's, you know, the Green Party, whether that's Reform, Labour, Tories, Lib Dems, and they're trying to say, actually, trust in us, we have this right. That feels like the completely wrong way to go about it for me. What we're talking about is a national position, understanding and diagnosing what our national position should be. So our consensus position from everybody on the spectrum as to what we feel is the right way to approach migration. We don't have that. We don't know what we're aiming for because we don't know what our national consensus position on migration is. So policies are just being made up to react to changing polls and changing voting patterns. So for me, the dialogue needs to not be, do I vote A, B, C, D, or E on this issue? It needs to be, what's the national consensus on this issue around what the sort of country we want to be? Because everybody has very legitimate reasons for their position, whether that's, you know, local grievances in terms of services being shut down, or, you know, having neighbours that who have been asylum seekers that they've absolutely loved and have integrated really well. But we need that consensus position, I think, as a country, rather than just voting for individuals who are constantly trying to persuade us that their position is correct rather than being a consensus position.
Yeah, before I come to the last question, let me ask you, following what Raymond has just mentioned about having common, and that would be putting the nation's interests at the center, because but I don't think that has been the case. It's been the left against the right. It's been Farage against this. It's been the Democrats against Republicans, which I think, again, when we talk about democracy, not just only in the peripheries or in Africa, even in mature democracies, liberal democracy, I think it's unhealthy. And the crop of leaders that we have in the last 10, 15 years has just been very, very terrible. Well, let me ask this about Brexit. So the Conservative, you know, came up with this Brexit, and you know, there's going to be some sort of money when the UK leaves EU. There's going to be this, there's going to be that. But in the last, I think it was 2015, last 10 years, it seems the economy has taken a hit for that, and it looks like a lot of war narratives that were given were not ones that were rooted in reality, or people were kind of like misled. Some people that voted for Brexit felt like they were misled. So, and then Raymond mentioned the Question Time and what's going on. How can people be informed about this reality? Because I think a lot of people are not really, really informed. And so how do the UK populace get, where should they get this proper information about the reality?
Yeah, I mean, that is such an important question. And I think, you can sort of see the Brexit conversation and through a very similar lens as the kind of broader migration one, in as much as refugees and migrants, it's very easy for them to become scapegoats. And it's really easy for politicians and others in public office to create and exploit xenophobia by prioritising fear over facts and just blaming newcomers for any of the social challenges that are in the country. And, you know, misinformation has played a really big part in this. And we've seen that all over the place. I mean, Trump has said some extraordinary things about immigrants eating their pets in Ohio and other things like that, that are just, it's quite frightening. And misinformation is really dangerous because it then, as we've said, drives policies that don't match up with reality. And the problem with this is it's not just bad for asylum seekers, but it's bad for the electorate, because bad policy making never benefits anyone. And obviously it's also bad for refugees and migrants, who are then, if you often push to the margins, and might suffer from in different ways as a result of that. So I think it is really hard to know in all of this where people should get their information from. And I think because there is so much hubris and so much misinformation, it makes it incredibly hard. But I think that there is an opportunity for people to really to do their research. And I think it's thinking, how can we strip away some of the noise and some of the sort of political standing that sort of surrounds this discussion, and have a little bit more of a sober debate about it? And that's a really hard question to answer.
And can I just come in on the back of that?
Yeah.
I think very briefly, one of the reasons it's a very difficult topic, migration, is because it's not a case of, you know, is like if you take the economy as an example, we might disagree on how to build the economy, but nobody in the UK is suggesting we don't want a stronger economy. You take the health sector, we might disagree as to how the NHS should be run, but nobody's suggesting we want poorer health service. Migration is different. There are people who actively believe we want more migration, people who actively believe we want less or none. So it's not a case of we all agree where we're heading anyway, and it makes it more complicated. And getting to the root of facts to diagnose people's positions or diagnose our own positions is really a critical part of that. And one of the things we've done is set up an initiative called The Truths Behind the Small Boats. So at smallboats.org, which is looking at exactly that, you know, looking at workplaces, town halls in local communities with students around, just sharing facts. We're not trying to convince people of a position on migration, that it's good or bad, but just understanding the facts so that people can make their own opinions and judgments.
I think that will make a lot of huge difference, because we need to look outside of official public for real information. But let's come to the last question. I'll give each one of you like 2 minutes each to talk about, where do we go from here? Where is the future? What happens in the next 5 to 10 years, from the interim to the long term? What do you think is going to happen? What do you project? Do you want to go first, Lucy?
Yeah, okay, go on. I don't know. I think it is hard to predict. I think that the way we treat people on the margins is often an indicator of the direction of travel. And I do think that it's a very sobering conversation, because where we begin to chip away, if you like, at the rights of refugees and asylum seekers, the next step often is the other rights get chipped away as well. So at one level, it's a bit of an alarm sound. But at another level, I do wonder whether the extent to which a lot of this discussion that's going on, I wonder if things are bad enough that people begin to question them. I don't know. That might be too optimistic, but maybe that's an alternative narrative. But let me hand over to Raymond, see what he has to say.
Yeah, sure. I think they're two separate things, right? What should happen next and what's going to happen next. What should happen next, I believe, is that we need to reverse a little bit of the examples that we're seeing at the political level, which is we're seeing people not understanding how to disagree and not being able to have cross-party or cross-society dialogue on these issues. It's really discouraging when we see 4 or 5 politicians from different political parties shouting at each other and accusing people of having the wrong facts. And I think this through the lens of my kids, and I think that's not how I want my children to understand how to disagree. Because the point is, we're supposed to be in consensus where we can. It's not happening at the political level, so I believe it has to happen at the community level. So I believe what we ideally want to see is cross-society dialogue happening at the community level across the UK, which is increasing as much as possible people's understanding of different perspectives on these issues. Because a lot of the perspectives, I think, around, you know, migrants coming to the UK and quote unquote stealing jobs or using services, they're grievance based. They're about legitimate grievances people have around life in the UK, I believe. If you don't address grievances, which is a wider issue, I think people are always going to look for somebody to blame, regardless of what the facts suggest. So I actually think what needs to happen is local level dialogue, real kind of honest civil society work that is what can happen to just begin to have it, not change people's minds, because that's advocating a position, but understand each other's opinion of healthy disagreement, but still having consensus on what to do about it. And we're not getting that example from our politicians. So the example needs to come from the grassroots up.
Yeah, thank you very much, Raymond. I agree 100%. And I agree with you as well, Lucy. I'm very, very grateful for the time and the rich insight into this subject. And I hope, as Raymond said, there needs to be a bottom-up approach to these issues where people at the community level are really, really driving the conversation. At least, maybe but at least let's drive the conversation. And see where we head to. Well, thank you very much for your time. And
reaching out and let us know when it's gone out.
Brilliant. Have a lovely weekend.
Brilliant.
Thanks for having us.
Have a good weekend.
Bye. Yeah, cheers. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode. And as usual, join me to thank our guest, Dr. Lucy Hoville and Raymond Defoe, for their very useful and passionate discussion and insight into the migration and asylum issue in the United Kingdom. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.